questions haunt every life, writes Andy Crouch. The first, what are we meant to be? The second, why are we so far from what we're meant to be? Hello and welcome to Restoring the Soul, a podcast dedicated to helping you close the gap from what you're meant to be and what keeps you from being all that. I'm your producer, Brian Beatty. Thank you for listening. On this edition of Restoring the Soul, Michael and Kelly Gray continue their conversation on how shame fuels addiction, concluding that shame is embodied, meaning it's in the body, with the body, and making the important point that as we experience shame, it's not just an emotion. It plays out in our nervous and cardiovascular systems, along with fear and anxiety. Now, before I hand it over to Michael, I wanted to say hello and thank you to our new listeners. We're glad you found us and encourage you to spread the word about the podcast. Let others know that we're here. Also, take a moment to leave a comment or review at the point where you receive the podcast. Restoring the Soul is a grassroots effort that doesn't have huge marketing dollars to get the word out. We depend on friends like you to help make the magic happen. If you'd like to get on our weekly mailing list, simply visit restoringthesoul.com and let us know. So without any further delay, here's your host, Michael John Cusick.
Welcome back to the program. It's Michael, and once again, we are in the Restoring the Soul studio high above Eeny Meeny Sushi and Old Chicago Pizza on the sixth floor of the West Cross building, and we're glad to be talking with you today. Hi, Kelly.
Hey, Michael.
We are on another episode of talking about ways that shame fuels addiction. Last time we touched on how shame creates distance and disconnection, and how that disconnection opens us up to seeking out a relationship with a person, substance, or process that doesn't really require anything of us. And this big idea today is that shame is embodied. So this reality that shame is embodied is an aspect of how that fuels addiction. So are you ready to unpack that?
Yes, quite ready to unpack that. So I think that this word gets thrown around a lot these days, and I'm happy that it has made it into our cultural lexicon. But what does it mean when something is embodied?
Well, my mind goes to prefixes and suffixes. And okay. The prefix of M, as in empathic, to me, it really means to be with. And embodied is with the body or in the body or alongside the body. And that's not to say that it's outside of us. But it's the idea that as we experience shame, that it's not just an emotion that floats around us, or as we think about emotions as it's in this kind of invisible spiritual heart, that shame is something that plays out in our nervous system. It plays out in our cardiovascular system. It's embodied where we can experience a racing heart, dry mouth, blushing. It's really common for me when I feel shame to feel heat rising up to my face, jittering or shaking. And then the classic response of fear or anxiety, which is really a state of hyperarousal of our nervous system. So shame is when something gets triggered, and whether it's the exact same part of the nervous system or not, that we feel a sense of threat in that exposure, a sense of danger. Sometimes people will have a feeling, and I talked to a friend about this recently, and I'm saying, what was that like for you when there was this moment when them feeling exposed? And they said, I just wanted to run out of there. Mm-hmm. So again, it's not an emotion. It's how this experience of exposure kicks in something in our body, and we want to fight or flight. We want to flee or push against it. And back to this idea that we get big or we become small.
It really is an excruciating feeling. I mean, it is physically kind of torturous. And I've said it has to be, it's hell. I mean, it feels like you're burning up. You're burning alive, but you're not, but it's never stopping. The flames are unquenching. They just burn and burn and burn. and it hurts your nervous system so much. And so our minds really race around, how do I stop this? How do I make this go away? And hiding is usually a pretty fast thought that gets supplied.
Gosh, I can't help but take what feels like bait, not from you, but just conceptually, when you're talking about flames. Mm-hmm. And if we looked at the idea of a literal hell, mm-hmm. that would be a sense of flames, of incineration, mm-hmm. but that fire, metaphorically in the Old Testament, is really a picture of shame, and how mm-hmm. hell, on an experiential level, not a literal level, is the sense of shame and exposure and isolation and disconnection. And therefore, shame is the experience of not being with God and in his love. Now, that is not true for right. the one who is in Christ, that we can't be separated from God. But the feeling of shame can absolutely make us feel that way. And even if we know in our head that that's not true, it's a classic example of the body keeping the score, mm-hmm. that our nervous system tells us truth that overrides the truth that might be cognitively inside of us.
Right, right.
I want to read a quote from our friend, Kurt Thompson, who has been on the podcast before, and I alluded to his definitive work on shame. And he writes, that book is The Soul of Shame. And in there, he writes, one of shame's primary characteristics is its isolating effect, intrapersonally and interpersonally. Interpersonal isolation impacts us neurobiologically, which is like oxygen that addiction needs to breathe. I just want to take a second and unpack this, because we're talking about shame and addiction. So last episode was about distance and disconnection. And so he says that it isolates us. But here's the bridge to today and the embodiment. When we're isolated, we don't have access to the love, the care, the presence, the support, the compassion, all of those things which are representative of love, which actually impact us neurobiologically. This whole field of interpersonal neurobiology, which is part of what we do here at Restoring the Soul and the lens we have, it says that on a neurological basis, we get our needs met. So the infant receives the gaze of the parent, who looks into their eyes and at their face and smiles and is sing-songy, and that gaze and that presence brings a soothing to that infant, to their nervous system. And that infant doesn't say, mommy or daddy has a great voice, and I love their blue or brown eyes. That infant in their nervous system reads what's happening interpersonally, and their nervous system can rest and relax. So when shame comes, the distance is created. It has a neurobiological impact where shame can have more and more power because we don't have the resources either within ourselves or in that relationship where the other, the caregiver, the one that loves, can reach to us and give us a sense of what we need.
Would you call shame a traumatic experience?
I haven't ever thought of it that way, but I would say it is. Let's define trauma. Trauma is any experience, event, or environment that overwhelms our system and leaves us without resources to cope. That's a real simple definition. And therefore, shame overwhelms our system. The moments that I go through my life where I think this was a moment of shame that has buried deep inside of me, that was overwhelming. And I would have done anything at that moment to make it go away. By definition, shame is leaving me without resources to cope.
Totally.
I'm on my own and I'm alone because I'm unworthy, I'm inadequate, and I must either be bigger or smaller. So yes, shame is a trauma.
My super simple definition of trauma is any time that we are dehumanized or we experience dehumanization. And it feels like that's easy to put on a continuum of, I can be aware that that dude that flipped me off in traffic when I made a mistake, I felt mildly dehumanized by him, and it took me a minute to shake it off, but it didn't ruin anything about my day, all the way up to really awful, horrible assaults, violations, being dehumanized in very large ways. But so when you say it leaves us without resources to cope, that just really sounds like quite an opening for an addiction to come in, because you're looking around for your fig leaf, anything outside of yourself to cope with that overwhelming experience that you have been through.
And that addiction then provides relief mm-hmm. for the absence of the care that would come from the other, which impacts us neurobiologically. And that addiction also seems to close the gap of the distance and the disconnection mm-hmm. while medicating the pain or helping us to avoid the pain. Here's another quote from Kirk Thompson, and then I want to ask you about a recent experience on a farm, because I think this is connected, even though it's funny and tragic. Mm-hmm. Kurt says, and think of this through this lens of shame is embodied from the soul of shame. The emotionally nauseating experience of shame is in a continual two-partner dance with our addiction, each first leading and then following the interpersonal and neurobiological steps of each other. If someone were to ask me, how do you heal from an addiction? Somebody recently did ask me this, and I said there's two words, relationship and regulation. So as Kurt talks about this two-step dance between addiction and shame, relationship is I will find a way in a 12-step group with a therapist, by confessing a sin, by confiding my wound or my brokenness or my trauma, I will find a way to close that relationship gap, because shame has said, get out of relationship, don't trust being naked and unashamed, and there's distance and disconnection. So relationship closes that gap, and it begins to give that interpersonal neurobiological sense of safety. The regulation, regulating one's nervous system, are learning ways, tools, techniques, practices of self-care to help us live in a way where we can be present within our own body, where we can live within, we talk about this a lot, the window of tolerance, where normal emotions of life, the ups and downs, can keep us in a relatively grounded place. Relationship and regulation. And really, as those two intersect, that helps with this whole aspect of embodied shame.
How I see that, I totally agree. How I see that is the old biblical language around the natural man versus the spiritual man. I will say that the natural man, I feel like what is being referenced there is just the autonomic nervous system, and that something gets triggered and that we make very, very fast fight or flight responses. And that's the sympathetic nervous system. But we come up with these fast answers just to make it go away as quickly as possible. And that it takes this extra work of observing, of owning, of confessing, and not like in a shame-based way, but just in I'm going to name what I'm struggling with here. And a surrendering to move forward and find a new way. So to be able to go and get that, the relationship and the regulation that you're talking about, it's extra work. And that is such a narrow way and few who find it, because we just want to stay stuck in those automatic responses to covering and dealing with our own pain.
It is hard work. It is a narrow way. But I believe it's the way toward integration, mm-hmm. where we don't have to have a part of us that is wounded and feels shame and isolated and distant that can't be integrated into our life. And so people might say, I want to be a person of integrity, or I want to be holy. You can't have integrity in the deepest sense of that word and be holy if there's parts of us mm-hmm. that are unknown or relegated because they're somehow unacceptable mm-hmm. because of the shame or the pain. And so to go after those yes. parts of us is the pursuit of wholeness yep. and holiness and integrity.
It's an intentional work.
Absolutely. Thus the invitation from Jesus of come follow me
yes.
to the cross. To the pain,
yep.
to what you define as life. If you're willing to let go of that, then you're going to find life. And for me, that's often Not that I need to sell everything and move to Africa because Jesus is saying that's my cross. The giving up, the letting go of my life is what I believe to be the safe route, what I believe to be the way that I can function and be self-sufficient. Like, I don't want to go there and dig that up. But what if Jesus says, dig that up where you'll be out of control, where you might not know how to manage it, where it might feel overwhelming, and you're going to find something that is a lost treasure.
My yoke is easy and my burden is light, whereas the burdens of my flesh, of my shame, of my dysfunctional ways of trying to solve my problems and cope with them, that is actually so extremely exhausting and heavy. So we think it's going to be so much harder, and people so often find, oh my God, I feel so good. I feel so free after just naming that and saying that out loud. Do I have to talk about the farm?
Yeah, okay. Tell us right. About what happened in the state Wyoming. North of Colorado.
Okay. I will tell in the context of shame. So I have to start the story the day before. We had gotten this really cool invitation to go to a cattle ranch with some friends, and it was my friend's parents' working cattle ranch, and I spend just a lot of time in Denver and in the suburbs, and so I was so excited to go and be on this farm with all these animals. I got invited to do a cattle drive on Friday, the day after we got there. I am riding my horse towards cows, and they moo and run away from me. They're so scared. I'm super powerful, and so I finished this four-hour experience, and I'm like, I got this. And so then the next day, I'm standing around outside talking to the moms and kids, and some sheep start pouring out into the driveway. And so I have this, you know, I now have ownership at this ranch, and I say, what are the sheep doing? Oh no, they have escaped. And I said, do we need to catch them? And they said, yes. And so I'm a sprightly 42-year-old. So I took off running, and I try to cut this sheep off. And my deep assumption is that she's just going to see me and be scared of me and turn around and come back. Well, I kind of like lunged to put my hands in front of her face to make her turn around. And that huge pregnant sheep tries to jump over me, and she ends up kicking me in the face with her hoof. And I hit the ground, and I am bleeding. And I mean, there are probably about 20 people scattered about this ranch working. And the shame voice says, you dumb muggle, you thought you could handle farm animals, and look at how you got schooled. And so everybody was so kind, and it was super embarrassing, but I felt lots of shame feelings.
And it caused some real damage for you.
It broke my nose and it blacked both of my eyes.
Oh my gosh. Mm-hmm. I mean, I knew this, but this is the first time I've heard the story in such detail. Uh-huh. I know it's politically incorrect, and you know, men and women sometimes talking about appearance. But I mean, this was hard for you. Your eyes were blackened. You sent our staff a picture of yourself, and mm-hmm. was there a kind of shame there about not only did I mess this up, but now this has affected my appearance?
I mean, I've never ever prayed for a nose job, and I'd had people tell me that they have been praying for nose jobs, and I said, I sure have not. Yes, it was, I mean, it made me put my money where my mouth was, in that I cared, but I didn't care a ton. I mean, I kept on coming out. We ended up staying at the ranch after we chatted with an ER doc who said there's nothing they can do for several days. You don't have any of the awful, you know, like you can breathe and you're not gonna have a horrible blood clot or something. So I would show up, I would come out to the dinner table. I came out to the dinner table later that night, and there was a group of teenagers that were on the ranch, and they were playing cards. And I emerged from my bedroom, and they all turn around, because of course I'm the cautionary tale from the ranch, you know, that day. And I said, do you guys want to look at it? And all the heads nod. And I just come over and I lean in and I just let them inspect it just looked like the Elephant Man, just the swollen eyeballs. And so, I breathed through that because I knew I'm just a nerd. And so I knew this is good for me. I am so much more than my face. I'm not trying to show off. I have so many other.
That is fascinating. The reason why I asked mm-hmm. is because many times for me, and as I've worked with clients, there's a sense of how one experience of shame can be like dominoes lined mm-hmm. up, and mm-hmm. one experience then triggers the other mm-hmm. and they fall into place. Mm-hmm. But, you know, you did exactly if we go back to Genesis 3 from the last episode,
yeah,
it's that sense of I'm going to drop my guard in the things where I hide, and I'm going to step into relationship.
Yeah.
And hey, do you want to see? No withholding of yourself.
Yeah, I didn't have any makeup out there. Not the fancy, the awesome makeup that I have to wear to do my intensives.
The stage makeup.
I totally have Hollywood level makeup for doing my intensives. But I've sent my intensive clients, I sent them the pictures too, just so they could, I don't know, enjoy, marvel. I mean, it's a wound is fascinating. We really do want to study it and stare at it. Ooh.
That's a whole other episode.
What do you want to say about
that? Well, I just want to say, just the final question. We talk around here about when shame is embodied, that one of the things we can do is begin to learn our shame triggers. And I first heard this idea from Brené Brown that talks about shame as a kind of internal whirlwind or an emotional tornado that happens inside of us just to represent the strong somatic embodied reaction. But for addiction purposes, people are often told, identify your triggers for the addiction. You know, don't keep candy in the house. Don't eat late at night. You know, make sure if you're in a restaurant where alcohol is freely flowing that you're with a friend. Know those triggers and then you can manage them. And what I found is that very often learning those triggers is not successful towards sobriety or freedom. But when people identify their shame triggers, what is it that elicits that embodied flood, that internal whirlwind, that then they can say, oh, this is why I would turn to this substance, this behavior, this process, or this person, because it's really to ameliorate the shame.
Everyone who comes in for an intensive gets this bonus information of tracking their emotions in their bodies. Because it is, I mean, as we've learned from somatic and sensory motor therapy, it is this amazing backdoor of information to your emotional world, and that we often have very automatic reactions to the physical feeling of our shame, and then we begin our behaviors that might not be super helpful to us. So when someone can say, it feels like a bomb goes off in my chest and my neck and my face get super, super hot, I can say, great. I mean, I'm sorry, but great. Be present with that and watch those sensations move through you. And the act of watching them move through you is really keeping you out of acting them out in some way. And then you discover that, like Dan Siegel teaches us, even the most powerful emotion will dissipate fairly readily if you just allow yourself to observe it, breathe through it, let the flow, let it go. I love that the word emotion is mostly the word motion, that it's just trying to move through. It's trying to go someplace. And so you really can breathe through your shame, and then you can get to the other side of it and see a little bit more clearly and make sense of what makes most sense to do next, rather than just have a trigger off a cascading set of events of just trying to make yourself feel better and get away from the experience of it.
Yeah, that cascading is actually a better word than the picture of the dominoes, because mm-hmm. a lot of people go, what are dominoes anymore? That's a pizza store. But the cascading effect that, you know, one ripple causes the other. Let's end on this. In Surfing for God, I talk about a principle of self-care, what I call the soul care cycle instead of the soul snare cycle, urge surfing, which was coined by a professor at the University of Washington that worked in addictions. And urge surfing, he came up with this metaphor because he was with his family at the ocean and he and his kids were, you know, in the waves playing, and they would, you know, be 100 feet out and the wave would come and they would try to go into the wave and get past it. And the wave would just wash over them with the breakers and the white water and, you know, twirl them around upside down. And he said, it suddenly came to me that if I turn and let the wave lift me, and if I surf with the wave, it's not going to put me in this place of turmoil, turn me upside down, you know, have me coughing and spitting. And so we could speak of shame surfing instead mm-hmm. of urge surfing, because mm-hmm. the context of that was addictions. Mm-hmm. But this shame surfing really bridges the gap between how shame fuels addiction and to be conscious and aware. And in the book, Urge Surfing, and what we're going to call now Shame Surfing, is the acronym OFF. And the O is to observe, to observe the physical sensation of the shame. Where do I feel the shame? Well, for me, it's often a burning nausea in my stomach. It is a dry mouth and red face where I feel warm. So I simply observe that. And specifically, you can close your eyes and observe it and focus on one particular sensation. And almost like a telescope where there's a circular view of something, you're just closing in until that telescopic circle is like the size of a pin. And you observe in this very focused, narrow, particular way. But while you're observing, it's no longer shame. It's this pinhead size of sensation. And what that does is it dismantles the power of shame. And as you said, if you simply observe, focus, that's the second F, just mm-hmm. focus on that small sensory place. Mm-hmm. And then the F is follow up. Just observe, focus, follow up, observe, focus, follow up. And if you do that for 2 to 10 minutes on the high side, as you said, the emotion will pass. And once that embodied flood that comes over us, that internal whirlwind dies down, we can often say, oh, that was the voice of shame telling me I'm worthless. And that's what my body is screaming to me, but I know otherwise. And then you can say, here's what's true. I'm beloved. I am fearfully and wonderfully made. I am sufficient. And so let's wrap up on that.
Sounds awesome.
Thank you for this conversation. And to all of our listeners, we would love to hear feedback. You can give feedback on iTunes or on any of the other podcast platforms. Oftentimes these podcasts are they're wonderful, but they feel like a one-way relationship, and we want to shape the program and talk about topics that will be helpful to you. So please do check in with us.
Can I say one last thing about shame?
Please.
It is an absolute lie that it won't pass without using your substance, that the shame won't pass unless you use your substance. It is such a hard thing to stare it down and use your off method at first, and then you get totally hooked on that because it is the most amazing way to release your shame without any additional regrets piling up.
That's beautiful. We can unpack that maybe in a separate series as well. Thanks, everybody. Talk to you next time.
So we've wrapped up another episode of Restoring the Soul. We want you to know that Restoring the Soul is so much more than a podcast. In fact, the heart of what we have done for nearly 20 years is intensive counseling. When you can't wait months or years to get out of the rut you're in, our intensive counseling programs in Colorado allow you to experience deep change in half-day blocks over 2 weeks. To learn more, visit RestoringTheSoul.com. That's RestoringTheSoul.com.